Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We'll be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Fair is underway.
Fair is underway.
We actually won the Ecke Family Award for our display, which turned out pretty nice this year. I was very pleased.
Well, when you have dragons in it,
yeah, it's a pretty cool dragon too. I have to admit the other exhibit that I thought was that they well the Garden Railway exhibit is just insane.
Always good though.
And you know, having done Garden Railway exhibits in the past at the fair, what a nightmare. I mean, I just cannot believe how much work they put into that. It's absolutely phenomenal. So that's really neat. But the Fern Society exhibit I thought was interesting as well. They had a lot of interesting specimen ferns there, and actually quite a few different staghorns. I think most of the ones that they had were species staghorns, some ones that you don't see very often. They had a. There was a Ridley eye there.
Ooh, that's a nice one.
And Denham. Mm. Yeah, some neat stuff. Mm. So if you get to the fair, which I hope a lot of you will, be sure to stop by the Flower and Garden Show and check it out. Oh, also a tribute. And there was Patty McGinty did a tribute to the nursery.
I was about to ask you about that. Mm. Yes.
It turned out very well.
Yes.
Yeah, turned out very nicely.
And John, you often have been a judge. Were you judging this year?
I did not judge this year. I was a little busy this year.
Oh, and the other thing too, and it just keeps getting bigger and better every year. And we mentioned in the past, Rich, our friend Rich Hawes, who manages the infield farm, has once again outdone himself this year with just an amazing display at the farm. So go out to the infield and of the track and check out the farm. Rich and his crew have done an amazing job there. And
now, we have talked in the past of perhaps bringing him on the show at some point.
I need to talk to him about that and see if he would be willing to do that. The amount of work that he does out there is amazing. And I think a lot of people don't realize they have a program called Plant, Flower, and Grow, which is for school kids. Sorry, thought I was going to sneeze. Which is for school kids, and they used to do it during the run of the fair, but then they realized that most of the kids in San Diego are out of school during the run of the fair, so they didn't have that many people would come. So now they do it a couple of weeks before the fair starts. So he gets his whole thing started way before the fair even gets underway, so that it's all ready to go for that program. So it's pretty neat.
The plant grown eats through third grade, so kindergarten through third grade. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
I guess they all get an apron, and then they have different stations around the farm, and they go through and they collect all this stuff, and then they go and turn it in at the end. And I think there's a bee section out. There's an apiary section out there. He sent me some pictures of the sunflowers that he grew that are
ginormous.
They're enormous.
Yes.
And he told me I want to say it's a Middle Eastern sunflower, but they're over 10 feet tall.
Wow.
I mean,
the mammoths get really large. I've grown mammoths that get significantly, easily over 10 feet.
Yeah. And the flower heads are 12 to 18 inches across.
Right.
Just incredible. So, So make sure you get out to check out Rich's farm out at the infield. And
a lesson to us all, you know, Rich starts that, I'm sure, 3 months ago.
It was a long time ago.
To get this going, to look good during the run of the fair. And I've been planting quite a bit the last couple of weeks, some pumpkins and melons and squash, things like that. This is the time. It's actually past time by about a month probably to get those things in.
Yeah, for it's getting late for pumpkins.
Getting late for pumpkins, yeah. And squash are okay, but watermelons, that's 105 days to harvest.
That's a long one.
It's a long one. Yeah. Got to get these things in. Yeah. Plan ahead.
So the when October is approaching for Halloween and coming in and asking if they can start a pumpkin for Halloween, that's not the time.
That's not the time.
Okay. Yeah, the time if you're coming at that time to start a pumpkin, you need to go to Vaughn's or something. Yeah, like that.
That's right.
And get your pumpkin.
Absolutely.
You're not gonna grow anything in that amount of time. So anyway, so the fair runs through. I guess it runs through the 4th of July is midweek, so I guess it just runs through the 4th this year. They're not gonna carry it over on the weekend like they do. And it gets close to the weekend. So be sure to check that out. Classes today in San Diego, we have carnivorous plants with Chris from the San Diego Carnivorous Plant Society. That should be an interesting class if you are interested in carnivorous plants. It's not just Venus flytraps. There's a lot of different ones out there to check out. And that's at 9 o'clock in San Diego. And Poway at 9:30, it's going to be summer rose care with James. He's going to be doing the class on summer rose care. So he'll fill you in on everything that you need to do to keep your roses looking good and blooming through the summer. I actually need to go out and do a bunch of rose pruning on. I have some that I haven't pruned in quite a while.
Capri just deadheaded a bunch of ours. I had some pretty significant rust this year, which we haven't had in the past, but got it under control.
I haven't seen rust, but there's just so much junk in mine that I need to. It might be there.
So you have to. Is that WD-40? Do you use that for rust?
Yeah. For the squeaky roses. Although back in the back corner of our backyard, Melanie planted I can't remember which one. It's a purple climbing rose. Can't remember which one it is now, but she planted it up against the fence so that it would grow up against the fence, and she was just in this constant battle with the gardener who would come in and would cut it back every couple of weeks. So she finally laminated a sign here at work and took it out and stuck it up. It says, "This is a climbing rose. So I think she's got that. I think she's got that situation somewhat under control at this point. But
the perpetual battle with gardeners is that they are doing what they shouldn't do and not doing what they should do.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was talking to my neighbor last night. He's lives around the corner from me, and he doesn't have a huge front yard, but he's got a lawn in his front yard, and it goes down a slope, and his house faces south. So in the summertime, it just gets beaten in with the sun. And because of the slope of his lawn, he can't get enough water on it in the summertime to keep it looking really nice. So he's been having issues with he's had the same gardener for, well, as long as we've lived there, so almost 30 years.
Wow.
But he's just tired of the issues with the gardener, that knocking over landscape lighting and stuff like that. So he's said, the lawn's coming out. Lawn's coming out. Artificial turf is going in, and my gardener's going away. he's done. But
and then he'll need a blower to keep the artificial lawn clean.
Yeah, like my friend in Poway who put artificial turf under his Podocarpus gracilier trees in his front yard. And he made sure that he ran irrigation to them. But he said after he put the artificial turf in, he said the only way he could get the leaves that fall off of the Podocarpus up, because they do drop a fair amount of foliage, was he had to use his lawn like a vacuum cleaner and run it over his artificial turf to suck up the leaves. So.
One of the things we encounter frequently, it's shocking to me how frequently this happens, and that's that people have gardeners they've had for a decade or two decades, or a very long time, and they're horrible. The gardeners are awful. They do a terrible job, and they'll hire us to do the good work and to bring things back, to do the very skilled labor, and then they'll say, but I can't, I don't have the heart to fire so-and-so. And so here's what we'll do. You guys come on the second and fourth week, and he'll come on the first and third week. And I go, why do you want to pay somebody
to do nothing or
to do bad work?
Yep.
And but he's so nice. We just can't do it. And that happens more than you realize.
Yeah.
I do know that, because we have customers that come in and we give them suggestions, and they say, I guess I'll have to do that because my gardener can't, he won't do that, or he won't do it right. And I'm thinking, well, why do you keep the gardener if you are telling me that it's he's not meeting your needs?
Yeah.
Well, so. I made the mistake a number of years ago. I thought I was paying too much for my gardener. Mm. So I hired another gardener who has taken care of a bunch of other houses in the neighborhood. And after about a year, I was looking around the yard like, oh my God, no.
No wonder it's less money.
Wow. And so then I hired my old gardener back. And
at a substantial increase.
But they brought the yard back. And he's really good. I've known him since I was a kid. The guy who owns the company, I've known him since I was a kid because he actually started out. He's a landscaper, but he has a maintenance division here in San Diego. But he actually started out as a truck driver for us when he was in high school. So I've known him forever. And he's really good. He's really responsive. They do a very good job taking care of everything, generally taking care of everything. If there's something that I need that I want to put in, I just spot it in the yard and leave a note. Can you plant this? I come home and it's planted properly and everything's set. If I have a leak in a sprinkler line, I just put a pin flag out on it and let them know. They come out and take care of it. They're very good. That sounds
exactly like our gardener.
You?
Which is me.
Which is you.
The same exact thing. I go out and say, there's a leak here. I need to get to this.
Yeah. So actually, I found one the other day.
Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here in KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. George found an interesting website called positivebloom.com, and I was looking at it this morning as we were getting ready for the show, and he had sent us a particular link to an article that was posted there by Wilma Eldridge, and it's the fire-resistant California ground covers that replace bark mulch around homes. And before we get into this, the interesting thing about that is that the reason why this is relevant is because of the zone zero that everybody in California is talking about right now. And I think in zone zero, I don't think it matters whether it's fire-resistant or not. I don't think you can have it next to your house.
As I understand it, you are correct. Yes.
So, this is kind of this will be an interesting topic to go over because there are some fire resistant plants, which if you really want to try to harden your landscape, these may be something that you want to use a little bit farther away outside of zone zero
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Even though it says around homes, that doesn't necessarily mean touching
your home.
5 feet, 10 feet out. Yeah. Right?
Although we were talking about it the other day in the neighborhood, and somebody said that they had talked to somebody and they said that if you have like a wooden pergola attached to your house, that because it's attached to the house, that it doesn't count as zone zero, doesn't count as flammable in zone zero. So I need to, don't take my word for it.
Well, we need to bring our Cal Fire captain back and ask some more questions.
Some more questions. Yeah. Because that was
our concern. You know, our house has that very large front porch. That is, it is the house. It's part of
the house.
And it's wood.
Yeah, and see, I have a pergola. I have a huge pergola off the back of my house that is wood, but
it's not attached.
It is attached.
Oh, okay.
But why would I have to replace a wooden gate that's attached to the house and not have to replace?
I was going to ask you that.
The pergola. So yeah, this is nothing on the from what I understand at this point today, nothing has really been set in stone. As far as zone zero is concerned or what the state is going to mandate. But as we have mentioned in the past, it doesn't matter what the state mandates.
That's right.
It's what your insurance company mandates. So you best to start thinking about put a game plan together. If you do have to make changes to your house, what are you going to do? As a matter of fact, I just went through and took a bunch of ground cover out of the front of the house that was right up against the house. Not necessarily for zone zero. It's been something that I wanted to do for a while, but I'm thinking in the back of my head before I go through and redo all of that, what are we going to do to not come up with the situation that we were in before? I don't want to go through and re-landscape it, then have zone zero come down six months away and have to go through and redo it all again. So
conversely, put a bunch of new plants in that even though they are fire resistant or at the right spacing, something comes into insurance says, no, that's not
it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've been wanting to do it for a while. So it's, it's a good excuse.
It is going to, and we've said this before. I think we even said it when our Cal Fire captain was on the show. It is going to impact, and not just a cost impact, a visual impact. It's going to cost something for people to remove plants or put other plants in. But from a visual, you know, a lot of people have put a lot of effort, time, energy, money into their plants, into their landscaping, and they have hedges or shrubs and flowering plants all near their home, not necessarily against it, but within that zone zero, which is the home, you know, when you're driving up to the driveway, beautiful hedges or flowering beds and such. And that is going to be a tremendous impact for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Visually.
I'm fortunate.
Us included.
I have a planter in the back, on the back of the house. That's going to have to come, out if this does go through. The stuff in the front, we're going to redo that anyway, so that's not that big of a deal. The side yard, nobody goes in the side yard, so that's pretty much cleared out anyway. And then the other side yard is all concrete, so it's not going to be a huge effect for me, but there's a lot of people that are going to have a lot to deal with.
Well, where I live, a lot of folks have tons of planting materials to kind of hide their house and make it look more out in the country and secluded.
And my neighbor is like that. Right. And I don't think that was what they intended when they put the landscaping in, but you can barely see your house when you drive down the cul-de-sac.
And if you're on the sidewalk, please get off.
If you're on the sidewalk, that's another problem.
Well, the other thing too is the cost of all these things. I guess I'm still living in the past when I started the landscape business back in 1980, 81.
Yeah.
Minimum wage was $2.25. You know, I was calculating jobs based on $15 per hour cost in order to meet my expenses. You know what our cost is now?
It's
$80 an hour is what it costs for landscaping or gardening service.
Right.
Landscaping install, we calculate it out at about $140 an hour.
You know, that's what you're going to pay.
That's what you have to pay.
Any skilled tradesman. Yeah.
So we have to go back to, I don't think I'm getting paid enough for all that stuff I've
been doing. The neighbors just put in, they took the gates out because they were wooden. And they put in steel gates now. And they look nice. But it was $10,000 for two gates and just the little bit of abutment to the house with the gate.
Yeah, with the returns.
$10,000.
Yeah, I think I spent $6,000 on two steel gates, and I went with the cheap steel gates. There were two different. There was a good gate and there was a better gate. I went with the good gate, and I think it was about $6,000 for two gates. And if you have to replace wood fencing, the cost per foot for those gates, that's the same as what you're paying for. Just a run of fence. Yeah. It's expensive and it adds up really. Even the wooden fencing that we replaced was over $50 a foot.
Wow.
So
a foot. Wow.
I'm living in the past, guys.
Me too.
You know, see, that's the other thing too, is that you start going back and looking at that. I remember when 5-gallon Eugenias were $10 and they're 50 now.
Yeah.
Probably somewhere around there. Yeah. I mean, it's,
which you put in to make a beautiful screen that you have to take out.
That
now
I just
because
took out.
The way.
Yeah, I took four Eugenias out of my backyard because we have to replace. They were right up against the fence line and they were too close to the house. I had to take them out to put the new fence in, and I'm not going to replace them because they were too close to the house. Also, and as soon as they took them out, I walked in my backyard. We're like, oh my God, there's a hole in our landscaping now that was not there before. Right. So. Yeah, it's all something to think about. So anyway, this is a fire-resistant California ground covers that replace bark mulch around homes. Bark mulch is one of those landscaping habits that feels harmless until fire season hits. It dries out fast, ignites easily, and sits right up against the structure, so it's supposed to be decorative. I wouldn't say that it dries out fast. I mean, if anything, that's what mulch does. Is it holds some water.
Well, and if they're talking bark mulch, bark really does not ignite nearly as readily as mulch. If it's like arborist wood chips or shredded
wood chips are going to be worse. Yeah.
Wood chips are worse.
Yeah, yeah.
But bark, by its nature, protects trees from catching fire. So
yeah.
I think there's a distinction to be made there.
Yeah. So let's see.
And also well hydrated.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, if you're watering it regularly, it's not like an ember is going to fall on the mulch and your house is going to burn down. Yeah.
But a firestorm is a completely different animal.
A firestorm is a conflagration is a completely different. Let's see. California homeowners and fire prone area for California homeowners and fire prone areas, that is a real problem that a simple swap can fix. Fire resistant ground covers offer everything bark mulch does visually while actually reducing the risk around your home instead of adding to it. They stay low, fill in bare soil, and create a living barrier that does not feed a flame the way dried organic material does. California has several excellent options that are drought tolerant enough to survive the same conditions that make fire season dangerous in the first place. I might have some issue with that. we'll go on.
It's still going to collect debris.
It's still going to burn if it gets hot enough. Yeah.
And it makes a nice habitat, though, for wildlife, including your snakes.
Yes. I love the fact that they have the Pigeon Point County bush for right next to the house, because that is such a great habitat for rattlesnakes. They love that.
Now, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And when they say around homes, they're not talking against homes.
I would think so.
But my thoughts exactly. When they talk about being a good habitat for wildlife, my mind, I have workers at the house today doing some work, and they opened up our back French doors to go in and out. And I told them, gents, when you go out that way, just keep an eye on the ground.
We do have rattlesnakes here. Yeah. Yeah. So as you mentioned, John, the first one on the list is Pigeon Point Coyote Bush. I'm not a huge fan of Bacchus just because
I
don't like the look of it. Yeah. I know it's in the right place and for what you want in the right place in the right situation. Yes. It's an excellent native, but
it is popular. We sell a lot of it here.
I know we do.
I like the Pigeon Point, but I don't like the upright forms. I dislike them intensely.
What's the one that's so freely self-sows around here? The shrub one, big.
Oh gosh, I forget the binomial. But it is, But it's just invades everywhere. Right. But Pigeon Point, I actually like I just did a video recommending it for use on slopes because it'll retain a slope very well, stays low rather than ice plants and things like that. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I like it just as sort of a placeholder as a low shrub. You know, a foot or less. I think they're pretty nice, but I'm with you. Normally, I think that coyote bush is ugly as sin.
It stays green and relatively moist through the hottest parts of the year. I'll give you that.
Well, maybe it'd be a nice plant for a distant slope as opposed to, you know, something right near the home.
Yeah, planting it is easy. It thrives in full sun, handles poor, rocky, sandy soils without complaint. Yeah, okay, I'll give you that. It produces tiny white flowers. The flowers are completely inconspicuous as far as I'm concerned. Yes. I would not, if you want flowering plant, I don't put that one on your list. But anyway, it has its uses. Twinberry honeysuckle. That's one that I am not familiar with. Are you familiar with that one, John?
I've used it. It's okay.
Is it a Lonicera?
It is, actually. It is Lonicera. Okay. Let's see.
Lonicera involucrata.
Yeah, that's one I'm not familiar. That's one I'm.
I find it to grow awfully slowly, so it wasn't one that I would typically use. And also, you know, one of the things about natives in California, I did a video recently too about being not an exclusivist when it comes to natives. I love natives. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, we get people who are just hardcore, 100%. You can only plant natives, and they're such zealots about it. And I think. Be pragmatic and do what works. But on the other hand, when you say native to California, are you talking about Yosemite or Point Reyes or Carmel? That's a far different.
Or Anza.
Or even Northern Baja. Yeah. San Diego County is very different than those other places. And so California natives, you know, in truth, I think that you could say native to our county and our growing conditions. But try to grow stuff from Point Conception here, and it's not going to do very well.
You know, redwoods will grow here, but they're not going to grow like they do in Santa Cruz.
And we've talked about that too. You have the native plants that do very well here, the native for San Diego County, but this is a Mediterranean climate, and there are a plethora of Mediterranean plants that thrive and do well and give you the same look and the same thing that you're looking for, which is low water.
Right. And that's really what we're after.
What's interesting on that honeysuckle, though, that twinberry honeysuckle, is that it's more of a yellow flower. Yeah. It's kind of neat looking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's semi-shade and actually pretty thirsty, I've found. A lot of what we sell as California natives are actually pretty thirsty.
Yeah, it prefers moist soils. Yeah.
Well, they'll survive with less water.
Yeah.
But they look better when you water them.
Right.
You know? What I found interesting when I looked that one up, Ken, is it grows in all the way up the coast to Washington, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho. And oddly, This is from the U.S. Forest Service. I was looking at Michigan and Minnesota.
Interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, snuck in up there.
Snuck in.
Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We're talking about some fire-resistant plants that you can put in your yard when we're facing this Zone Zero situation. We'll be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And we're talking about fire-resistant plants for your landscaping, and which is becoming more and more prevalent in San Diego, all throughout California, as we are facing the debate about Zone Zero and what that's going to do as far as changing in your landscape is concerned. We're moving on in the list to Caramel Creeper Ceanothus. I actually do like Ceanothus. It's amazing how many Ceanothus are available on the market now. Everything from very tiny microfoliage varieties to the Ceanothus, was it arbifolia? Mm-hmm. To
the tree farms.
A tree.
Yeah, large
it's
trees.
An actual tree. And everything in between, and including some of the ground covers. And the Caramel Creeper Ceanothus, it's a nice one.
It is nice. And
it's one of those ones where if you give it a little more water than it typically needs to stay alive, it actually looks really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have that beautiful blue flower, California lilac. It has the beautiful blue purple flower in the springtime. And you know, it covers quickly, suppresses weeds effectively. Doesn't dry out bad. Doesn't blow around. I would say that's probably
what your experience, George and Ken, are with Ceanothus. Though, I'm very judicious about where I put Ceanothus because I call it a 50-50 plant. I'm going to kill one for every one I plant.
It sounds like that's how you speak. It's about
50% loss.
That's how you speak of Proteas.
That is true. That is true too.
I agree, and I think one of the problems, and to Ken, you just said, you know, as long as you give them a little water, they look good. I think too much water is where most people kill them.
Yeah,
they give them too much summer water and they just don't do well. And I don't know if they get a fungal issue. I would
think it's usually the tough throw.
Yeah, just too much water.
And especially when I find for a lot of plants, when you get really hot weather, we get a Santa Ana blows in and it's 105 and plants are just wilting, you know, and people go out and water during the heat of the day.
Mm-hmm.
That I've seen native plants die almost overnight from that, and some Proteaceae too. Within 2 weeks, they just instant death. So it's difficult to remember, but don't water these when it's hot during the heat of the day. Make sure it's well mulched, but
but not mulched next to the house, right?
But not next to the house, right. But typically in your right. garden under normal circumstances. But I like Ceanothus, but I just find them difficult to grow. And sometimes they'll grow 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then overnight they spontaneously abort too.
Yeah. So, you know, the other thing, when we're talking about giving the native plants some extra water, that I've mentioned on one of the previous shows that I had read about, and this makes perfect sense to me, if indeed this is what happens, what I was reading, was when the plants get into a drought situation, the water content of the plant starts to drop, but it leaves behind more concentrated oils in the plant. Mm-hmm. And it's the oils it's not the water that burns in the plant.
Mm-hmm.
It's the oils. So if you increase the concentration of the oil, the plants can become more fire prone.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say flammable, but fire prone. Yeah. Sure. So even with a little bit of extra water, not only, in my opinion, not only will they look good, but I think it will dilute that oil content down a little bit too, and help make things less flammable. Mm-hmm. Moving on, creeping sage. That's not one I know there is a ground cover. Well, I won't say a ground cover salvia. It's a very low growing salvia. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which one it is, but it's one of the natives we've had. I can't remember, but I know I planted it in a planter in my yard that we use for pollinator mm-hmm. habitat, and it grew very very quickly, mm-hmm. and it stayed very very low. But that was the problem. It didn't get any height to it,
right?
And it just didn't work in the situation that mm-hmm. I put it into. Let's see, do they give a
They give the botanical on there. It's Sonomensis, I believe. Mm-hmm. Sonomensis.
Okay. So, yeah, that might be a...
It's
might
pretty.
Be a good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It almost looks, if you've seen photos of it, it almost looks like one of the spreading lavenders a little bit.
Okay. Way, yeah. Okay. Point Reyes Manzanita. It's a very low growing one. That's another native that has just exploded in the market as far as availability is concerned.
Cultivars.
Yeah. Sure. It used to just be Manzanita uva ursi was the only one that was available. And now there's everything from, I mean, completely lay flat ground covers to almost tree form.
Trees.
And I actually do like Manzanita. I think it's really pretty. It has that very characteristic red trunk to it.
Right.
But that's another one, though, that I know in wildlife, in wildland areas, that if there's a good fire burning,
oh yeah,
man, it'll burn.
It burns very well.
It burns pretty
and they can get big. I, on my property in Julian, I've got Manzanita that you'd swear these are trees. I mean, they're good size.
Well, I showed you guys those pictures from when Blake was home over Christmas break and we went up to Palomar. And there were Manzanitas outside the observatory up there that had to be 30 feet tall.
Yeah.
They had trunks on them that were 8 to 10 inches across at the base. They're enormous.
Yeah.
But the beautiful part is that they keep that glossy red bark to them.
It's very pretty. Yeah.
I remember going, I don't know if you did this, John, growing up here at summer camp where they take you up to the mountains in sixth grade. One of the things that they had different crafts that you could do. And one of the crafts that I remember you could choose to do was they gave you a stick of Manzanita and you could polish it.
Absolutely.
Made a candle holder. This 1 foot long piece of Manzanita that was all shiny. And that was
very pretty wood.
Yeah, it was very pretty, but
One thing about Manzanitas too, I have a couple of clients that have purely native yards. It's very distinctly and very well done. Just very, very nice look to them. But you have to be very careful, even pruning Manzanita. I find I'm insistent that our staff sterilize their secateurs, their pruners every single time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can.
What are they susceptible to?
They get disease. And so, and you can have it enter through the cuts you make. And so I am very meticulous about making sure that everybody's tools are sterilized. In fact, most of the time I'll just say, I don't want you to touch Manzanitas. I'll just do Manzanitas. And they're also somewhat difficult to prune. It's a little bit like doing lavenders, where if you start to prune into the heavy woody parts, it just dies. And
it doesn't come back.
It doesn't come back. They're a little tricky to prune, but I find they're a little disease prone too. So
I have a big, a huge rosemary bush that was growing along the back fence of the property, and it was encroaching into an area where we had some roses. So I had the gardeners go through and cut it back, and it still hasn't recovered. Yeah. The plant itself is fine, but that side that got cut off is all brown and woody still.
Yeah.
It doesn't regenerate real quickly. Yeah. So that is something. And I that's my fault for letting it get that far. Mm. If you keep up with it,
right,
right. Yeah, it's very responsive if you take care of it
without really hacking it.
You just have to do it all the time.
You know, the Manzanita, though, we didn't mention, it's in the same family, the heather family, as blueberries.
Yeah.
So if you look if you look at the flowers, they look like blueberries.
Yeah, they do. Emerald carpet Manzanita is also on the list. That's another one of the ground cover ones. That's a really pretty Manzanita.
I
like that one. That's a good one. Cape Blanco.
I was going to say, it gets big though. It's like a foot tall, but it gets like 8 feet wide.
It spreads.
From that one little plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It spreads. Cape Blanco stone crop. And stone crops are very, that's a succulent plant.
Mm-hmm.
They don't.
It's a sedum, right?
I'm
not a big fan of a lot of the sedums. I know they have a place. I know they have a place.
There's some that I like more than others, but, and pretty much anything that's going to be other than ice plant. The problem with ice plant is from a fire standpoint is not the plant itself, because it's so fleshy and wet that it's not going to burn. It's that understory, undergrowth that dies back.
Yeah, the duff underneath.
Yeah, that's what burns.
Where all the snakes are hiding.
But all of these were Snake Harbor.
This Cape Blanco stone crop, people see that it's a succulent and they think instantly, oh, it's desert, and put it in full sun it's going to sip water. Where's it from? It's from Oregon and the Northern California coast. So again, it's probably not really suitable for our area, unless you're on an east exposure or north exposure.
Or filtered light from filtered a large light. Tree, yeah. Right, which yeah. won't be too close to the house because of zone zero.
Yeah,
right.
it even
and it's going to be thirsty again. Right. You know, if we're trying to get away from water use, a lot of these are going to be
thirsty. It even says right here that this native sedum grows wild along the Oregon and Northern California coast, so it is well adapted to cool, foggy conditions. That is not a drought-tolerant condition.
No.
You know, no. Back to John's earlier point about when you say native, that's a native plant. Grows exactly. in Northern California.
Right. Exactly. But it is
not suited to San Diego.
Not drought tolerant. Yeah, not suited to full sun,
right.
low water in San Diego. So be aware of that. So, that was the last one on that list. I think kind of interesting. So if you're interested in learning more, or you want to see the full article that Wilma Eldridge wrote, it's available on positivebloom.com.
And we will link it on our Facebook page.
Link it on the Facebook page. So,
you know, and a tremendous website that I think is such a good tool for people to use for planting natives is Calscape.
Right.
You know, and fellow who started that is Dennis Mudd, who lives right here in Poway up in the Grove, just below you, George. And his house, I've been to his garden. It is totally natives. And it doesn't look like your typical garden. It looks like you're really going to visit a county park or Cuyamaca where it's wild. It is wild. But it's lovely in its own way. It's probably not everybody's taste to do with their home landscape. But he developed a website that is phenomenal. And it goes through all of the native plants of California. It gives photos, their uses,
locations,
yep. cultural needs, and I can't recommend that website enough. It's really a good website.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still in publication or not, but John Leitner wrote a book on California natives that was outstanding. Mm-hmm. I think he wrote one, and then he revised it. And
that was the Native Plants of San Diego County.
Was it Native Plants of San Diego?
Yeah, I think so.
That might be it.
Have that.
Yep.
But that's if you can find a copy of it, that's an outstanding reference as well. And like I said, done right, native landscapes do look very, very nice. Mm-hmm. But as we've mentioned here on a number of occasions and just in this show as well, not all natives are drought tolerant or low water use. So you've got to pick and choose what you want to use, what you want to use. If it's done right, they are absolutely beautiful. Greg Rubin is another one who does
beautiful
landscapes.
Installs. Yep. And Mike Evans from now, unfortunately, defunct Tree of Life Nursery, the late, great Tree of Life Nursery.
I didn't realize.
San Juan Capistrano. They're gone.
I didn't know.
That's so sad. Another nursery bites the dust. But Mike Evans gave one of the best lectures on installing a native plant garden I ever heard. And he just said, you know, and he really likened it to Japanese gardens as a prototype or a paradigm, that in Japan, all the plants in a Japanese garden are native plants. Mm-hmm. And he said, but what makes a Japanese garden is not just the plants. It's also the design, the hardscape, the aesthetic, the principles. And so he essentially gave a lecture on how to take California native plants, but use the aesthetic of a Japanese garden and get a very, and I thought that was brilliant. I thought it was really one of the best things I'd ever heard, because too often people do native quote gardens. It looks like crap.
Hey, John, tell us how you really feel. Don't hold back.
You know, there's no design
right.
To it. There's no hardscape that is working with it. It's just throw all this stuff out, and it looks like going to Tecolote Canyon.
I was
going to
say, so it's almost like walking into a state park or a field somewhere, right? Chaparral.
Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And just a reminder, we have classes today in San Diego at 9 o'clock. It's going to be Carnivorous Plants with Chris from the San Diego Carnivorous Plant Society. Like we said, there is a whole lot more to carnivorous plants than just Venus flytraps. So if you have an interest in that, show up and check that out. In Poway at 9:30, it's going to be Summer Rose Care with James. Always puts on a lively class, and we'll give you a lot of good pointers on how to keep your roses looking good as we get into the hotter months during the summer. And also join us next week when our guest is going to be Mike Atkinson. He is coming back again, and he is the premier plumeria grower here in San Diego. So always a pleasure to have him on board.
I think he wants to talk a little bit about myth and lore about plumerias, too. So it should be interesting.
I want to hear about that. So
I call Mike the king of all plumeria.
Yes. Yeah. He's very, very good. Let's see. I came across another interesting article. I think it's from the same website that we talked about. Positiveboom.com. Excellent website. Yeah. They have some very interesting stuff there. It's by Isla Simmons, and it's Ohio gardeners can pollinate tomatoes by hand with these 7 easy methods. So don't you dare try these if you don't live in Ohio. But I thought it was kind of, over the years, we get people that come in and say, you know, I plant my tomatoes and they're growing like crazy. They're flowering, but they're not setting. One of the things that people used to come in and buy a lot, and this has changed over the years, was tomato set. Small spray that you can spray on the flowers and cause them to set. Back in the day, tomato set was actually a hormone. It was a growth hormone. Now I think and I don't even know if we carry blossom set anymore. I haven't noticed it out there in a while. I'll have to go and take a look. But the blossom sets that are out there now are no longer hormones. It's basically just a calcium fortified water. Mm. I'm not exactly sure what that does to encourage pollination, but yeah. That's what's out there. But the old hormonal blossom set sprays, I don't think are available anymore. Not that I haven't seen one in a long, long time.
We want what we don't get. You know, it's like we have blossom set for the tomatoes, but then we also have blossom stop for the olive tree.
Yeah.
Don't mix those two products in your garden.
Make sure you
right?
don't mix those
don't,
up.
Don't mix the
well,
two.
Well, tomatoes are a perfect flower. They have male and female.
Right.
And it's just, you know, whether it's wind or flower, I mean, bees or other insects or you touching them, you can help get them pollinated. But they are self-pollinating. Mm-hmm.
Well, that reminds me, a long time ago, we've had them on a few occasions, but they're incredibly hard to find, and they're not that easy to grow well, is Naranjilla, which is the golden fruit of the Andes, and it's in it's in the Solanum family, and I've grown it. I've never been able to get it to produce fruit before it died. But beautiful plant. And it produces, it looks like little, like large gold cherry tomatoes.
Well, like my physalis.
Yeah. But the problem was getting them pollinated, and in their native habitat, there's an insect. I don't remember if it was a bee or a wasp that when they land on the flowers, their wings beat at a particular frequency that sets off the pollen and loosens the pollen up in the flowers. And if you don't get that particular frequency, they don't always set. And I remember this goes way back. I had a plant and it was growing and it was flowering. And I had read somewhere that I think it was, I can't remember what letter it was, but if you got a tuning fork to a particular
frequency,
note, it approximated the frequency of the wing beats of whatever insect it was. So I remember being out on my patio with this stupid tuning fork, pounding it against stuff and going and holding it up against each of the individual flowers, trying to get them to pollinate. It didn't work.
Oh, I was going to say that's dedication.
I thought that was very interesting. Hmm. So anyway, here's some other tips that you can use. This actually goes for people that are outside of Ohio as well. So if you're having problems getting your tomatoes to set, you might give some of these a try. Tap the flower clusters gently. That's just get the flowers, just move it around. You try to get the pollen moving around and just tapping the flower clusters, running your hands over them. That's what I recommend people do that have trouble getting avocados to set fruit, is when those flower clusters open up, just go and brush your hand over the entire cluster, move the pollen around, and it will help pollinate and get the fruit to set.
Temperature matters on that, because tomatoes have a Goldilocks zone. If it is too hot, they're not going to set fruit. If it's too cold, they're not going to set fruit.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter what you do.
Right.
So a light tap on the stem just behind the flower, cluster sends a small shockwave through the bloom. Vibration is enough to knock pollen loose, and it can reach the stigma inside the same flower and fruit development again. So, yeah, so the tuning fork thing, that's not so far-fetched. Mm. Shake cages during dry weather. I guess they're talking about shaking the tomato cage. Well, I guess that's kind of like just shaking
the flower.
You just, just go out and grab the cage and whip it around and see if that changes anything with your success. Electric toothbrush kind of goes back to the
I've heard that one.
That goes back to the tuning fork, where there's a very high frequency vibration that goes in and can loosen loosen up pollen, similar to what a bee or a bumblebee would do. Brush pollen with a soft paintbrush. I guess that's probably about the, that's kind of along the same line of using your hand to move pollen around. I know that cherimoyas can be hand pollinated with it, but you need, it needs to be not a stiff paintbrush, a very, like a red sable paintbrush will give you much better fruit set on cherimoyas if you do that. Let's see, what else do we? Yeah, pollinate during warm midday hours,
but not above 90. The viability of the pollen starts to decrease the hotter it gets.
That's true. During the warm timing.
One of the things I had read was basically tomatoes are more productive when humans are comfortable outside. So when it's too hot and you don't want to work outside, they're not going to be as productive.
Watch the water on them when they get to that point too. I have a tomato grown in I actually have two tomatoes in one pot on the patio, and the pot's way too small. and I come home in the evenings and it's starting to wilt just because it doesn't have enough soil at the base of it to keep enough water to. So I come home, fill up a watering can, go and dump that on it. It's fine. And it's actually got a ton of tomatoes on it.
Well, this is a very San Diego tip for increasing pollination, but I've for years said that you should always plant African blue basil near your fruit trees and near your tomatoes, because I've never seen a plant attract more bees than African blue basil.
No,
it's not great to use as basil, but as increasing pollination, it's a little tough and chewy.
It's definitely a stronger flavor.
It's much stronger,
but for a pollinator garden, though.
Oh my gosh, amazing.
It is.
You'll have hundreds of bees on that thing.
Unreal.
So plant that near the tomatoes. Plant that. I put them around the orange trees, and it does increase pollination. You get so many bees in there that you can't help but have more pollination.
Yeah, it is. It is wild how many bees will go to that. And the one thing that's nice about it too is, especially if you're bee adverse. It is so attractive to bees is they don't care if you're around. You can actually go and cut big chunks of that off, and the bees will stay with the flowers. They won't. They won't come after you. They will stay. They will stay with the flowers. They are so attracted to it. It's amazing. I actually have a big one in my pollinator garden at home just for that very reason. It brings a lot of bees and pollinators into your yard.
John just said oranges. I forgot. I brought these mandarins for us to taste and forgot all about
sumos?
It.
Oh, we'll have to.
They are not.
We'll have to check those out. Does it repeat every few days? Okay, that makes sense. So you go out and just keep up with it, and sooner or later something's going to set. Skip wet blossoms after the rain. That's one of the worst possible moments to attempt hand pollination. That's interesting.
A lot of these things are true about rain or when things are wet. You know, it's been said for generations. My grandmother would tell me, don't ever go out in the bean garden when it's wet. You're going to spread disease around. So,
It says here, brushing, tapping, or vibrating wet flower moves soggy pollen that cannot perform its function regardless of the technique used. So handling wet petals also increases the risk of spreading fungal material from one plant to another during the season. Well, I think that would probably be true no matter what.
Right. But, I agree. Whether it's tomatoes or anything else, right?
So anyway, so if you're having some issues trying to get your tomatoes to set fruit, you might give those a you might give those a try. And if you want to see the article, the article in full, we'll have it posted on the website. And you can also check it out at, what's the name of the website again?
Well, if it's the same one you did, it's Positive Bloom.
Positivebloom.com.
Or go through the archives and look up Farmer Roy episode here on Garden Talk.
Yeah.
That man can grow tomatoes.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah. And I've never seen anybody grow tomatoes like Farmer Roy.
Oh, he's great. We're having a great tomato year so far.
I've actually harvested tomatoes already.
Yeah.
I pulled a couple off just the other day. Yeah. And I've got tons more.
I revisited an old variety bought from the Point Loma store. There was Juliet.
And that's a good one for Poway.
It does well in Poway in the heat. And I did Sun Gold and Juliet. I've been getting tomatoes already for probably 6 weeks. And I mean, more than one could eat. You know, I've been making sauce out of it, and just because they're so prolific.
We went with all smaller varieties. Well, I went with smaller varieties of tomatoes this year. One of them, I don't know what it was. Somebody had pulled the tag out of it, so we couldn't sell it. So Melanie brought it home, and I planted it. It looks like it's going to be like Sweet 100 or a cherry tomato. But the other one that I planted was Campari.
When
they're in season, you get them in the clamshells at Costco.
Yeah.
It is an outstanding tomato, probably my favorite. So I'm trying that out to see how that's going to go. I'm pretty excited about it.
A volunteer, what seems very much like that, growing underneath one of our fruit trees. It is spread probably about 6 or 8 feet on the ground. Haven't done anything with it, but we're harvesting daily, probably 8 to 12 pieces of fruit.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to be back with another hour of Garden Talk next Saturday. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.